It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we hear about the surprising friendship between two of American history's most legendary activists.
First, Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were in Milwaukee last night for a debate that covered topics like college affordability, Wall Street reform, and even some issues that hit close to home here in Wisconsin.
The debate comes shortly after Sanders won the New Hampshire primary. The Democratic race is tightening, leading to some tense exchanges between the two candidates.
Wisconsin not only hosted the debate, but state residents also asked them questions via Facebook.
Jesse Apoyan was there. She reports on state government and politics for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, set this scene for us. What was the crowd like on the way in, at the event, and after?
Sure. So one unfortunate thing about covering these debates as a reporter is you get sort of separated from the crowd and you end up a little bit sequestered. So the only crowd I really ended up interacting with a whole lot was the student population, which was, pouring in and out of the student union where we were hanging out just across the street from the debate. But, you know, a lot of students seemed excited and engaged in the process. We did also, I guess, interact with some protesters who came through, but You could still feel the enthusiasm from the crowd even across the street when we were watching the debate as it was streamed into that room for us.
And was the crowd, especially the students you ran into, did you see a sentiment more Sanders, Clinton, or evenly mixed?
Yeah, I talked to a few of both. I think Sanders does seem to play pretty well among the college student demographic, but I did talk to a few Hillary Clinton supporters as well, and they had a little photo booth where students could come in and take their picture with a cardboard cutout of the candidate they preferred, and I actually saw quite a few students taking their photos with both, which seemed to indicate
hedging their bets.
A lot of them weren't quite sure either.
Well, we mentioned there was a lot of Wisconsin in this debate, some questions from Wisconsin residents, in fact. One about black incarceration rates here in the state. How did the candidates respond to that?
Yeah, Hillary Clinton had a very Wisconsin-focused response to that. She had clearly done her homework or was already pretty well aware of Wisconsin's exceedingly high incarceration rate, especially of black males, and she talked a lot about the need for community-focused policing and the need for engaging kind of every level of the process once people are released from jail, so things like education and support for finding jobs. And Bernie Sanders' response was focusing more on eliminating what he called over-policing, but he also talked about the education piece and just trying to eliminate the feelings of discrimination that can be tied to that.
Now, speaking of Wisconsin coming up in the debate, Hillary Clinton mentioned Wisconsin a lot. Here she is criticizing Bernie Sanders' plan for free college and saying, hey, it has to do something to do with state governors, including one here in Wisconsin.
Governors like Scott Walker contribute $23 billion on the first day to make college free. I'm a little skeptical about your governor actually caring enough about higher education to make any kind of commitment like that.
So she was playing to a Wisconsin Democratic crowd there.
Yeah, that was quite an applause line for Hillary Clinton. All you had to do was say the name Scott Walker, Governor Walker, and she got people fired up. And that was a big theme for her, was kind of agreeing with Bernie Sanders and saying, hey, I like your plan, but mine is more practical, mine's more pragmatic, or mine is just going farther and doing better.
So Governor Walker, or at least his campaign social media staff, responded to that comment, didn't they?
They did, and this has been, when Governor Walker was a presidential candidate, he had a favorite line that he would throw at Hillary Clinton. He would remind her that she had been taking large speaking fees to speak on college campuses, and he has frozen tuition 4 years in a row to make college affordable.
Talking to Jesse Apoyan from the Capital Times about last night's Democratic presidential debate in Milwaukee. Clinton also mentioned unions here in Wisconsin. She mentioned Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee. Did it seem like she came in thinking, I'm going to talk about Wisconsin while I'm in Wisconsin?
Yeah, very much. That was the idea. And speaking with her campaign manager afterward, he said as much. He said, you know what, we're looking for every vote we can get in every state. We're here in Wisconsin. We're going to talk about Wisconsin. And they were pretty enthusiastic about that.
Well, let's give a listen to Bernie Sanders now giving one of his main pitches to voters last night.
But when today you have massive levels of income and wealth inequality, when the middle class is disappearing, you have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth. Yes, in my view, The government of a democratic society has a moral responsibility to play a vital role in making sure that all of our people have a decent standard of living.
Now, reporters, people talking about this mentioned Bernie Sanders didn't talk Wisconsin so much. Did his campaign talk about that?
They did. Their response was, we're not here to talk about a specific state. And that's because Bernie Sanders just doesn't have the name recognition that Hillary Clinton does at this point. You know, he's certainly gotten a lot more publicly acknowledged as the race has gone on, but he hasn't run a presidential campaign before the way that she has. He hasn't been in the spotlight as long as she has. And so his campaign said, you know, they're looking forward to coming in here and campaigning down the road, but they're still just working on introducing him at a broad national level.
This debate, a notable, and I think Hillary Clinton pointed this out, the first time two women had moderated a presidential debate, a majority of women on the stage, I think, was the way she put it. Was that something that people were really noting last night?
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if anyone would have been talking about that or mentioned it if she hadn't, but it was one of those things where you realize, oh, hey, yeah, Bernie Sanders is the only guy on this stage. And it didn't, you know, they agree on a lot of those issues to begin with, but what's interesting is he's actually doing very well among women, and particularly young women.
Now, a strange picture emerged. I think you had tweeted this, among others, a picture of Daniel Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Nothing weird there. Rebecca Clayfish, Lieutenant Governor of the State, Republican, and Scott Ross from One Wisconsin Now, an avowedly, I think they call themselves, screechingly liberal group. All together and smiling. How did that happen?
All together and smiling. Yeah, I think it was Bice who introduced the two of them. But there was a lengthy bipartisan discussion with some journalists too, just about you know, how people came to their politics and maybe even what policies they might be able to agree on, and generally just some congenial bipartisan bonding while we were waiting for the debate to get started. But definitely an image you're not expecting to see.
Are we going to see them for, you know, join a 3-on-3 basketball league anytime soon?
Yeah, you know, I'll be waiting for the Clayfish Ross ticket, I think, for the next election. We'll see.
That seems likely. I'd put my money on that. Any other notables? Is this a big scene for a lot of local politicians, activists to show up at?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I know there were a lot of state legislators were attending the debate, and in terms of coming to the spin room afterward to talk to reporters, we had Tammy Baldwin, who's been campaigning for Hillary Clinton, not only in Wisconsin but throughout the country. You know, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett was there also speaking on her behalf. I don't believe I saw any Wisconsin politicians there to talk on Bernie Sanders' behalf, but yes, definitely a hot spot for Wisconsin elected officials.
Do you feel, I mean, we've had a Republican debate in Wisconsin, a Democratic debate in Wisconsin. It looks like both of these campaigns could still be going on. They could still be at play by the time they get to Wisconsin. Do you think we're going to get a lot of love from presidential candidates this year?
Yeah, that seems likely, and that's what everyone's saying, too. I mean, I don't know that anyone expected the Democratic side of things to still be up in the air by April, but it seems increasingly likely that Wisconsin could play a role, and, you know, every campaign that I've talked to has said, yeah, we're looking forward to coming back. We'll be here.
Oh, and you'd mentioned before the debate a protest there. What was going on?
Yeah, there were protesters. They were mostly outside, you know, trying to catch people's attention as they were going into the debate. But at one point, they did actually come into the media area where we were all reporting to. And there are a couple different causes represented. Majority were there representing the fight for 15, fighting for minimum wage to be raised to $15 an hour. There are also some Black Lives Matter protesters there. And they came in for a few minutes. One of the chants was, you want our vote, come earn our vote, or come get our vote. So just kind of trying to get candidates to pay attention to some of the issues that they're maybe not talking about on the stage.
Well, candidates at a debate, obviously they're hoping to get some people's votes. I know we don't have Insta surveys of Wisconsin voters or anything like that, but your sense of leaving the debate last night, do you think either the candidates won anybody over here in Wisconsin?
You know, I think they both had their strong moments. As we talked about, Hillary Clinton had some really strong lines, especially when she went after Scott Walker and went after some of the policies here in Wisconsin. Bernie Sanders also got a lot of applause for some of the jabs he took at Hillary Clinton, reminding her she's not in the White House yet, some things like that. So, you know, it seems like it was relatively even, but I think an informal survey of elected officials and folks that I saw attending the debate probably coming out a little more in Hillary Clinton's favor.
We'll leave it there for now. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's state government reporter Jesse Apoyan helping us recap the Democratic presidential debate in Milwaukee last night. She covered it for the Capital Times. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
In his new children's book, our next guest tells the story of a friendship that might seem surprising at first glance. As it happens, the pioneering women's suffragist Susan B. Anthony and the famous abolitionist Frederick Douglass were friends. They had tea together and talked about ideas and how to support each other's causes.
Dean Robbins first picked up on that story in Rochester, New York, where Anthony and Douglass both lived for a while. Robbins is an award-winning writer and the author of the new children's book. It's called Two Friends, with illustrations by Sean Quayles and Selena Alco. Dean, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dean, tell us about when you did first catch on to the story that Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony were friends.
I've always been obsessed with heroic figures ever since I was a little kid. I've had a whole string of them that I wanted to be like when I grew up. And I love visiting places that are associated with my heroes. So I've dragged my family along to Rochester, New York. And we were there because I knew that both Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony had lived there. I didn't realize there was a connection between the two at the time. We visited Susan B. Anthony's house, which is now a National Historic Landmark. And the tour guide showed us Susan's parlor, where she said, oh, this is where Susan would entertain her friend and neighbor Frederick Douglass for tea. They would sit and chat about freedom and equality, and they pledged to support one another's causes. After the tour, my family and I were walking around the neighborhood where both Susan and Frederick had lived and stumbled on a little park where there was a statue of the two of them doing just that, having tea and talking about making the world a better place. Well, it immediately occurred to me what a great story this would be to tell for kids.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you think about it, they did have a lot in common. They were both fighting for the rights of people who were marginalized in the 1800s, African Americans and women. So what do we know about what that relationship was like?
Well, they both were courageous leaders of their respective movements, and they both were passionate supporters of each other's causes. Anthony pledged to support Douglass in abolition, and Douglass worked very hard to support women's rights.
And they were about the same age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Close to it.
Yes. Yeah, they got to know each other in the 1850s, and they had a lifelong friendship.
I was thinking about what it must have been like back in the day that they were friends. And here's a white woman, an African-American man. This might not have been a friendship that society would smile upon at the time.
It was very unlikely. But the two of them were always taking chances in everything that they did. They both led their movements in spite of widespread scorn and very dangerous threats. And this was just another way that they were both outliers.
And you said they pledged to support each other's ideas, so they weren't just friends. They actually took up the mantle for each other's causes. Do you have an idea about how that played out over the course of their lives? Did they remain friends till they died?
They remained friends. They had a little bit of tension at one point after the Civil War because there was a sense that women could get the right to vote and African-American men could get the right to vote. Was it possible for both of those things to happen? And it looked like it wasn't possible. It was too radical for both of those things to happen right after the Civil War. So people in the abolition movement thought that getting rights for African-American men first was the way to go. That was the sort of real politic of the day. And the women's movement was very unhappy about that. But as soon as the vote passed for African-American men, Douglass called for an amendment to the Constitution giving women the right to vote.
Oh, interesting. So there may be some restorative times there for the two of them.
Yes.
At that point in their lives. And you had to, for this book, you had to kind of imagine yourself into that friendship. Your book is the story of that tea that they might have had together as they talked about their ideas. How did you imagine it and get into that headspace?
Well, the first step, as with any article that I ever wrote as a journalist, is to do a lot of research. And for me, that's the fun part. I read a lot of books about Anthony and about Douglass. I had visited Susan B. Anthony's house in Rochester and walked around their neighborhood. And I just tried to let the story roll around in my head until it felt sort of real to me.
And so what do you think it would have been like, this relationship between them? Do you imagine it would have been kind of warm and informal? Or, I don't know, how did you think about what that would have been like?
I think it was very warm. They lived right near each other. They had tea all the time. They had so much in common. And I think it was informal and friendly.
We're talking with Dean Robbins right now. He's got a new children's book out. It's called Two Friends, and it tells the true story of the friendship between women suffragist Susan B. Anthony and abolitionist Frederick Douglass. So you're imagining the tea that they may have had together as they did when they were friends. Did you kind of feel like, you said you wanted to track your heroes that you had when you were a child. Did you feel like you wanted to hang out with these two and that you got to know them a little better?
I did. It's been fun, even after the book has been published, to reread biographies of the two of them. I just love people like Douglass and Anthony, who took on impossible fights to try to make the world a better place. In the 19th century, it was as hard as possible to do what they did. So being with people, I don't think I'm naturally brave myself. So hanging out with people like Anthony and Douglass just in books gives me courage to act a little bit more admirably in my own life.
What was it like seeing the inside of her home?
It's very well preserved. You could really imagine her in all the various spaces. Up in the attic, she had the place where she printed her newspaper, which was one of her pride and joys. She had a whole army of women working to turn this thing out. She eventually had to shut it down because she couldn't make enough money for it. She had trouble with finances her whole life. The women's movement wasn't very well financed back then, so she had to work for decades after it closed to pay off her debt.
And tell us a little bit, if you would, about the illustrations. They're beautiful. This was a team working with you, Sean Quayles and Selena Alka. How did they go about creating these two figures from history?
They're a husband and wife team. They've got a track record of beautiful children's books. I don't really know how they work. As somebody who had nothing to do with the art, I can only marvel over the painterly richness of the illustrations they came up with. I think they picked up on a mood in the text and evoked it beautifully. If you've noticed, they embedded words in everything, and that was a wonderful surprise to me when I saw their sketches. You see words in people's clothes, in the road, in steam coming out of a cup of tea, even in butterfly wings. I think they picked up an idea in the text where Susan and Frederick are constantly reading and writing and talking about freedom and equality, and I think the illustrations show in a poetic kind of way that their words were spreading everywhere and that people were starting to agree with them. I think the illustrations really make this a book about the awesome power of words.
So what did you take away having written this and lived in this sort of headspace with these two major figures? Did it change you at all?
Yeah, I think we're living in a time when people are questioning American heroes, people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, whose behavior didn't always measure up to modern-day standards. To me, it's amazing that Anthony and Douglass's behavior did measure up to modern-day standards, even though they lived 200 years ago. They both insisted that America live up to the highest ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and they never compromised their principles. To me, it's amazing to just wrap your mind around two people who were so far ahead of their time in terms of their moral vision and who were willing to work so hard to make it a reality.
And Susan B. Anthony was arrested at one point, wasn't she, for voting illegally at the time?
Yeah, she was arrested after voting in defiance of the law in the 1872 presidential election. She was tried, found guilty, and fined. And she used the opportunity to send a powerful message about women's rights around the world. She defied the judge's order to remain silent in court, famously telling him, "You have trampled on every vital principle of our government. I refuse to pay a dollar of your unjust penalty." So, very inspiring.
Now, you wrote in the afterword, it's a little poignant. They did both win their battles. Slavery was abolished in 1865. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1920, and Susan B. Anthony had died by then. What did that make you think about?
Well, she famously said, "Failure is impossible." That was her last public statement, and I think she knew it was going to happen. And she had groomed successors, so I don't think she died feeling too sad about the way the future was going to go.
These two friendships, at the one hand, it is surprising that, as you picked up on, that the two of them were together, Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony. But on the other hand, who else could understand what you were going through at that time, being up against a huge societal wall there that they were trying to push through for these rights? You can imagine that they might have seen something in each other that nobody else could understand.
It was a lonely fight. There was a small band of reformers, and they tended to cluster around Rochester, a group of them did. Harriet Tubman lived around there, Amelia Bloomer, Elizabeth Cady Stanton wasn't too far away. So I think they drew strength from each other, but they both faced a lot of defeats along the way, so they needed support. And I think sitting down and having tea in Susan's parlor was probably quite a relief for both of them.
So what do you want children to take away from this book?
I hope they'll be inspired. I love the idea of children being as passionate about my heroes as I am. And I hope they'll read the simple story, even kids who are as young as 4 years old, and think maybe I can do something brave in my own life.
Oh, well, it's a fabulous, beautiful homage to their friendship. Dean, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dean Robbins. He's an award-winning Wisconsin writer. He's the author of the new children's book. It's called Two Friends, and it's got illustrations by Sean Quayles and Selena Alko. And the book tells a story of the friendship between women suffragist Susan B. Anthony and abolitionist Frederick Douglass.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time for Food Friday, and today we're turning our attention to baking, and in particular, to bread.
Bread baking can be a little intimidating if you haven't tried it. It is intimidating to me. Or maybe you've done it and ended up with, you know, a paperweight more than a delicious loaf of bread. But our guest today wants to help us feel confident and excited about making our own bread.
Sarah Black is a baker and baking instructor with 25 years of professional baking experience in New York City, and she's the author of One Dough, Ten Breads, Making Great Bread by Hand. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be with you.
So, Sarah, these days there's bread everywhere. We can pick it up at the convenience store or someplace a little more high-end. So why should we bother making our own bread?
Well, first of all, I think it's a really satisfying process. It's very relaxing. It's zen-like. And at the end of the day, you feel accomplished and with something delicious to eat.
And unlike a lot of cooking, Sarah, you mentioned that bread is really this tactile experience. And in fact, to get really good at it, you've got to really use that sense of touch. How important is that to the experience?
I think it's essential, and it's really the point of my book. Once people get past their fear, jump past that line, get their hands in the dough, then the rest of the bread-making learning experience comes so much more naturally, absorbing information after you've really touched the dough or felt the dough structure is just that much more evident.
Why is that? What does the dough tell you?
Well, I like to be able to understand if all of the ingredients have been mixed properly. I can tell the water to flour balance more evenly. I can feel fermentation. Fermentation's almost like putting the palm of your hand on your cheek inflated with air. So you can really begin to sense what your dough is doing just by touch or by look or by hearing. Even
hearing, how so hearing?
Well, there are certain ways when you mix your dough that the dough sounds like it's hiccuping, and then you know that you almost reached the end of mixing. But these are just little cues that people can pick up on, you know, when they're making their dough by hand.
Well, let's get to some of the basics here. First of all, equipment. What's the minimum level of equipment we need to start making some bread?
Well, I start in my book with one basic recipe, which asks you to use anything that's in your kitchen cupboards. Most people have measuring cups, and so I give you a recipe for using all-purpose flour and measuring cups and teaspoons, and it's just a matter of getting you started. Once you get past that point, I like to instruct the reader or my students to use a scale, and a scale I think is essential for starting to build a very specific and proper recipe and foundation that'll allow you to grow from that.
So why do you need a scale? What does that give you?
Scale gives you accurate measurements. If you pack your flour into a measuring cup or if you pour your flour into a measuring cup, you'll get two different measurements, a scale is simply accurate. It tells you the truth.
So let's talk about that basic bread recipe you mentioned. All-purpose flour you started with. What else goes into the basic, the one dough that's in the title
one
of your
dough,
book?
Right. It's flour, water, yeast, and salt, and those are the four elements of making bread. I start with all-purpose because most people do have all-purpose flour in their cupboard. But once we grow to the third or fourth chapter, I recommend using a bread flour, which is different from all-purpose. It has more protein in it. It allows for a better gluten structure.
And you said yeast. Now, I just made my first loaf of bread, of yeast bread, in years last week, and I noticed at the grocery store there's all these different kinds of yeast, and I wasn't sure what to buy, so I just grabbed fast-acting. But can you walk us through the yeast choices?
Well, yeah, I prefer to buy active dry yeast, and I warn against fast-acting because that normally asks you to use a higher water temperature. Your dough will grow more healthfully and allow a better flavor and texture with cooler water. Your interior dough temperature should always be around 75. So if you're using a hotter water with this rapid-rise yeast, you're beginning to kind of chip away at building flavor and good texture. There is a yeast called Saf Instant Yeast, which doesn't have to be hydrated before you use it. And I've been starting to experiment with that because, as you know, I'm opening a new business. We're beginning to recipe test, but I'm also looking forward to scaling up my recipes with a kind of yeast that will impact that process in a efficient way.
Talking to Sarah Black. She's the author of the new book, One Dough, 10 Breads, Making Great Bread by Hand. You can join in this Food Friday discussion at 800-642-1234. Sarah, we've got your recipe for ciabatta bread up on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go through that in a minute, but we heard that you were the person who introduced ciabatta to New York City. How'd that happen?
Yes, they give me that credit, and I'll take it. I was one of the first people to be making ciabatta, and I got a lot of play for it. I had become a paper maker prior to becoming a bread maker, and so I had experience in working with wet substances. Paper making is all about pulp and water, and ciabatta is really all about water, too. It's a highly hydrated dough, so it's a little bit intimidating and challenging to work with. I was used to it, familiar with it, so my ciabatta turned out beautifully, and I was one of the first people to introduce it to the New York City marketplace, and it took off because it's such a beautiful interior. It has a great mouthfeel and a very thin, crisp, dark crust.
So aside from that higher water content, what makes ciabatta ciabatta?
Well, it's normally a kind of ugly, plain bread from the outside, but I think the surprise is on the inside, and it just has huge holes with lacy strands of dough, and it's perfect for, you know, slicing horizontally and stuffing as sandwiches or sopping up soup. It's Italian for shoe or slipper.
So we've got that recipe again on the Central Time Facebook page for Sarah's ciabatta. Sarah, I wanted to ask, what are some common mistakes? Where do people often go wrong, where they maybe have that first bad experience with bread making and then give up on it?
Good question. I think that you can use the wrong water temperature, which will either, when you're hydrating your active dry yeast, if you use water that's too hot, you can kill your yeast. Water that's too cold, you won't allow your yeast to live and survive. And also, overkneading your dough can really destroy the texture of bread. It can ruin the gluten structure and just make it fall and kind of become brick-like. And I think steaming your dough when you first put it in the oven is essential for getting the potential of the best rise.
I want to talk about kneading the dough. Some people either love it, I guess, or they hate it. It's pretty labor-intensive. Of course, these days you can also use a stand mixer with a dough hook instead. Which one do you prefer?
Well, in my book, I start with the first recipe and explain about kneading. And I do so because most people are familiar with kneading. But from that point on, I use a process called folding. And folding is a much more gentle way of managing your dough. It's almost like folding a business letter. It also helps to protect the interior crumb structure. So after the very first recipe, all of the rest of the breads in the book use this process of folding. And you can, you know, make excellent bread with a stand mixer. I use mixers all of the time, but because I'm so aware of what a bread should look like or feel like, I know when to stop the mixer when it's mixing.
Another common mistake I've heard about, and you mentioned in your book, is, okay, you made your bread, it's warm, and you can't wait to cut into that warm, steaming
right.
loaf of bread.
Right.
Don't cut into the warm bread, am I right?
You're right, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because I disappoint 99% of the people I tell this to. They love to eat hot bread with butter melting on it, but during the first hour after your bread comes out of the oven, the moisture is still migrating from the center to the crust, and so the bread hasn't set. The structure will be gummy if you cut into it, and the flavors haven't set either, and so bread is really at its best when it's completely cool to the touch, usually about an hour after you've taken it out of the oven.
We are talking to Sarah Black, author of One Dough, Ten Breads, talking about getting started making bread from the basics to the advanced techniques. We'll pick that up in just a minute.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you love to make your own bread? And if you've run into roadblocks, can our guest help you out? What's your favorite kind of bread to make or maybe to eat? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation now with Sarah Black. She's the author of One Dough, Ten Breads, Making Great Bread by Hand.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a bread baker, what do you love about making your own at home? If you're not a bread baker yet, what would you need to know to get started if you've tried and failed at making bread? Maybe we can give you some help. What went wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. By the way, you can get a recipe there for ciabatta.
And Sarah, let's talk a little bit about sourdough bread. I guess this is one of the later chapters in your book about sourdough. There are even, I guess, sourdough hotels in Sweden where you can leave your sourdough when you're on vacation. What does it take to make sourdough bread?
What does it take to make sourdough bread,
yeah.
You say? It takes a real understanding of balancing all of the components of bread. But have you ever made a sourdough starter?
I have not.
No.
It's actually quite a great science experiment. I started this past summer, and you can really literally capture yeast by mixing flour and water together in a small container and containing them, putting the lid on your container, and then feeding them on a routine schedule for about 2 weeks. And it's a really interesting process to watch. But by the end of that 2 weeks, you should have a sourdough starter that will literally leaven your bread, and the flavors and the textures are really unique then to your own environment and your own tastes, and it's kind of a little dream come true if you're a true bread maker.
We heard from a caller who couldn't stay on the line. She says she grew up in a German household, found cardamom in pumpernickel bread adds a whole lot of flavor. That's a spice I wouldn't have thought to put in bread. Is that a common thing to do, Sarah?
You know, I've just started using cardamom, and I used it with chocolate and coffee in a scone that I'm recipe testing.
And
I'm in. Those flavors together were just dynamite. So, yes, I'm a fan of cardamom now.
I want to ask you a little bit more about your folding technique that you were talking about before. When I made my bread last week, I do fold it over, but I also kind of lean into it and not exactly punch it down, but push it down with some gusto.
Yeah.
Do you end up doing that when you're doing your folding technique?
No, I actually am very gentle with my folding, and it's more to just maintain an interior crumb structure that I anticipate for the final bread. But leaning can work, and there are many people who are proponents of kneading. There are certain doughs that benefit from a lot of kneading, certain pizza doughs, and so it's not that I'm against it. I'm just more comfortable with folding.
We're getting bread making advice from Sarah Black, author of One Dough, 10 Breads, Making Great Bread by Hand. You can join in with your questions, your tips, your favorites at 800-642-1234. Sarah, if I were to start making bread, and I'm a bread making coward, I'll own up to that. but my goal, I think, would be to get to making a good rye bread. And it seems like the challenge would be not like a dense bread that you serve with soup, which I love too, but a good light sandwichy rye bread. What's the key to making that?
The key to making one of your first rye breads is to make sure that you have a balance of both rye flour and a bread flour. Rye flour has much less protein to it, so it's much more challenging for fermenting properly, and you give it a little bit of a boost and a security net by adding a white bread flour that does have that protein. So in my book, you can certainly find a recipe for rye bread that will help you make the bread of your dreams.
Now, you've got this, your whole book is dedicated to this sort of one dough that you then build on, getting to 10 breads. And one of those breads along the way is focaccia. How do you get there from your basic bread dough?
Well, the very first bread dough is a stiffer dough, and I use it for baguettes. But the magic of the first three foundation doughs is that you only change the quantity of water to make a new dough. So a baguette dough adds maybe two ounces more water to make focaccia, and you would be amazed at the difference in dough structure. And the reason I taught my students this way is because when you feel the difference in dough structures, you learn the skill of handling the dough, and it really helps you in future bread making and shaping different shapes.
And just little differences like that, like a little tweak in the amount of water in a bread can make that much difference?
Yes, because to make ciabatta, I take maybe 2 to 3 more ounces of water and add that to the focaccia dough, and you've got almost like a pancake batter, which is scary and intimidating to some, but it's why I, you know, build slowly from baguette to focaccia to ciabatta. You get a little bit of time to practice before you get to the scary ciabatta dough.
Let's take a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Patrice with us in Horicon. Hello, Patrice.
Hello. Thank you for a great show. My question is regarding a bread called salt rising bread, which my mother used to make. She was from Kentucky. I wonder if you're familiar with it and if you might have a recipe to post.
Patrice, did you say salt rising or self-rising?
Salt.
Okay.
Just like the salt shaker.
I wish that I could say yes, but I'm intrigued and actually just read about salt rising or saw the title of salt rising bread yesterday. If there's anything that you can tell me about it, I'd be happy to learn.
Oh, it's just a marvelous bread. It's very thick, very dense. It has a starter. It's yeast and salt, and it sits for a couple of days.
And what's the end result?
And what does it taste like?
It's just wonderful. It has almost a sourdough taste. It's incredible when it's toasted. I grew up with it, and I've looked and looked for my mother's recipe and can't find it.
Oh, yeah. That's what I haven't heard of.
You have me curious.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that call, Patrice. I hope you can find a recipe for that. And, Sarah, do you collect breads, in effect? Are you always looking for something new to give a try?
I am, and in fact, I'm opening a business with two other women in the Columbus, Ohio area in the next 6 months. So we are recipe testing as I speak, and I'm more interested now in working with regional grains and ancient grains and looking at healthy, clean options for crackers and bread that I'm responding to from the public.
Right, I saw you have recipes for crackers at the end of your book. Again, how do you get from your basic dough to a cracker?
Well, let's say you've made ciabatta and maybe you have a little extra dough left over. It's so easy to make that into a cracker. You just take an oiled baking sheet and with your newly developed hand skills, you can very gently stretch that dough to the corners of the sheet and let it proof, but not long, and you can top it with a variety of toppings, let's say a little olive oil and some coarse salt and maybe rosemary. It bakes faster than your breads. You have to keep an eye on it. But when it's finished, I can promise you that there won't be any left within 10 minutes after the crackers have cooled. They're truly delicious and so easy to make.
So do you have to cool your crackers for an hour or two?
No, but they do cool much more quickly than bread. So if you're anxious to taste your bread, I recommend trying crackers.
Yeah, can you tell I'm anxious?
We had a caller named Dallas, Sarah, who's wondering if you can give a tip on making pizza crust. Pretty similar concept, I imagine.
Well, there are many different ways of making pizza crust. My friend Amy Sherber of Amy's Bread in New York makes a delicious pizza, and she kneads her dough very vigorously. On the other hand, I use a focaccia dough for my pizza, and I don't knead it, but I just stretch it, let it contract, stretch it, let it contract until I've gotten the round that I want. Pizza is best baked on a pizza stone, although you can bake it on a sheet tray. And, you know, it's really simple that way. There's nothing too complicated about it.
And, Sarah, as we wrap up here, how do we know when our bread is done?
Well, the age-old test is to pick your bread up, turn it over, and tap on the bottom to see if it sounds hollow. I rarely do that. I think it's just a matter of the many years I've had in bread baking, knowing the look, the color, just the amount of time that has passed. But for a novice, follow the instructions, get your base time, and maybe just pick it up and feel if it has lightness to it, which tells you that, you know, the water has baked from it.
We'll leave it there for now. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity.
That was Sarah Black. She's a baker and baking instructor with 25 years of baking experience in New York City. She's the author of the new book, One Dough, 10 Breads, Making Great Bread by Hand. We've got her recipe for ciabatta on the Central Time Facebook page.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
That's Bela Lugosi as Dracula, for some people the only Dracula, in the movie that premiered on this day in 1931.
Now, the anniversary would have been tomorrow, according to the original plans, but the director, it turns out, was superstitious and didn't want his movie to be released on a Friday the 13th.
So vampire movies okay for a superstitious director. Friday the 13th, though, that is off the table.
That's bad luck, Rob.
Yeah, I haven't watched the original Dracula in a long time. I used to be really into vampire movies, so we used to have vampire movie nights. You?
I love vampires, and my thing is, I wish there were more vampires. Now, the zombies are everywhere.
Right.
Everyone has booted out the vampires, brought in the zombies.
Yeah.
I just can't get into zombies.
Yeah, I mean, I like some zombie stuff. Yeah, I've always preferred, and, you know, vampire movies that have kind of fun with it. Lost Boys, going back to the 80s, I guess, a lot of Lost Boys, Fright Night. The Hunger, a little more serious, late David Bowie.
And you're a big Twilight fan, going back a few years now.
Bern, you like Twilight, though. I haven't
I
seen
do.
It, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I do. I like Twilight, I admit it. I thought it was especially the first one I thought was really well done.
All right, vampire music going out here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.